From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to 2017 and the January episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, the Zimmerman Telegram. Throughout this year, we'll bring you more never-heard-before interviews with veterans of Bletchley Park and its outstations, celebrating our ongoing oral history project. We'll also bring you freshly researched stories about what the Codebreakers achieved and the difference it made to the outcome of the war in our It Happened Here series. This month's It Happened Here story didn't actually happen at Bletchley Park, but let's not split hairs. It's important, and it will soon become clear why. But first, many's a time I've said you never know who you might meet at Bletchley Park, and eagle-eyed listeners may have spotted the TV historian Dan Snow waxing lyrical on social media recently about the wonders of the home of the Codebreakers. He came to visit, and like most people, when they first see how brilliantly the story is now told, he was moved and amazed. He stopped for a chat with Bletchley Park's very own broadcast-friendly historian, Dr. David Kenyon.
I've got Dr. David Kenyon with me, who is Bletchley Park's history man, but I've also got the history man, Mr. Dan Snow. Hello, Dan.
Hello, how are you doing? I mean, I think if I'm in the same room as David, I feel a bit dodgy about being called the man. I mean, this guy is the walking... I mean, this is... I first met you, David, doing First World War battlefields, so this is a bit of a sideline for you, all this crypto stuff from the Second World War. You're the world's leading expert on First World War cavalry, last time I checked.
I was, but I'm rapidly becoming an expert on signals intelligence in the Second World War, yes. It was a bit daunting when I started, but a year and a half in now, I'm getting the hang of it a little bit.
It's a bit scary. Did you have any specialism at all? Because this is not an area that you can just pick up and put down, is it?
It isn't. I'd read one or two books.
That's good.
As you do, you know, been interested in the Second World War along the way. But in some ways, they were looking for somebody who could bring a completely fresh eye to the story and just kind of learn it from the beginning without any preconceptions. And although I was slightly intimidated by it, on the other hand, it was really exciting to be presented with just a whole new field and the liberty to spend all day reading about it, really.
It's an amazing job to be backed by a museum like this of this quality and with this much material. But okay, this is my question to you. Pretend there's no one listening to this. Do you genuinely, hand on the heart, understand how the Enigma machine works?
I know how the Enigma machine works. If you ask me about the bomb machine,
okay,
I would have to move my hand slightly. But my theory is I don't need to know how it works. I need to know what it does and why that matters. That's the big story, really, is what it achieved and why that was so important. Which exact way the wheels go round isn't really the big story.
Absolutely. Well, you've got some amazing volunteers who I've met here that do that bit. So actually, yes, you can just plug into them if you need to. But it's been a good day here because we've been talking to lots of important folks from BAE Systems and government and stuff about what Bletchley did. And I guess you were providing all the serious firepower, and I was talking a little bit about the intelligence war and the context for the achievements of this place. And I mean, just revisiting all that material again just made me realise that this is really, well, it's the most remarkably successful coup in the history of military intelligence, isn't it? I mean, what the Allies were able to achieve by late 44, 45, in terms of reading all German signals and things, is pretty much unprecedented, isn't it?
It's completely unprecedented. I mean, the thing that is special about Bletchley is that all the different things that were done at Bletchley were done by other countries. The Germans did some of it, the Americans did some of it, the Russians, everybody else. But nobody pulled it all together into one place and made it a unified system the way it was here. So it's not that the Germans aren't breaking some of their codes. They are. But they never really get their operations together. I mean, you were saying in your piece this morning about the disorganization of German intelligence. And that's a real factor. And also having political leaders that are prepared to listen to it as well.
I'll say, without wishing to get too political, I did find in the course of this studying for this sort of day, it was a bit depressing because, I mean, one massive advantage the Allies had in World War II over the sort of insane fascist regimes in Germany, Italy and Japan was that the Allies' leaders prized the truth in as far as they could discern it. and largely rewarded people for telling them things, even if they didn't want to hear it. We forget that that was a huge advantage for the Allies, is that we sort of had sane people that were interested in reality.
And it wasn't necessarily experts either. I mean, Eisenhower comes to the game freely admitting, I know nothing about this. I've not done this before. You need to teach me what I need to know. But he was sufficiently open-minded about it all that they said, well, right, this is how it works. This is what you need to know. And he was able to exploit that and command effectively as a consequence.
Dare I say, he listened to the experts.
He did.
It's an unfashionable concept nowadays. But it was interesting. It was because they were there with their cybersecurity hats on and they were trying to persuade people that that what happened here, and going back to Room 40 and indeed the army intercepts in World War One, but Room 40 in World War One, which I've done a lot of work on recently about Jutland and the naval war, the huge strides that were made in terms of intercepting enemy messages, decoding them and using them, taken up by Bletchley and what was, and then going on to GCHQ. I mean, the work is, we're still part of a kind of seamless process here that's going on today. And now, of course, everyone's talking about cyber and communications and whether it's our own consumers, our own bank accounts, whether it's our own phones, household appliances, or big, you know, nuclear power stations. I mean, it must be quite exciting as a historian working in this field because it feels very current.
Very much so, yeah. And we try and exploit that with our education program and our other activities that we are specifically engaged in trying to train people about cybersecurity in the modern age. And, you know, I occasionally do school groups. And when you talk to them about, you know, the idea of me reading all their text messages, you can see them all suddenly looking very nervous. But it is that relevance still. And I think as well, people tend to forget that, you know, GCHQ, the NSA, the organization that they consider nowadays to be unnecessarily looking at their Facebook account, is actually the organization that saved us from Nazism. You know, this stuff has to be done, whether you completely agree with it or not. The threats are still out there. We were hearing at lunchtime today about the threats that are still out there, both criminal and national. And it's a good job that's all still going on.
But I just, for me to come here is, you are at one of the most important historic sites on planet Earth, really, because this is where Turing, I mean, we're looking out the window now at the building where Turing went up in the attic, and snacks were passed up to him so he could have a good old think about how to break Enigma. And perhaps even more than that, as you've pointed out, not just breaking an enemy code, but working out an entire system of information management that is a sort of basis for the whole of modern computer science. And that happened there. We're looking at
the
place.
The gadget workshop was in here where we are now. This was a Apple and Plum store at the time, so it just had sort of timber racking on the sides. And they came in here with basically kind of Meccano and wires and old coffee tins and built contraptions.
Tinkered about,
yes.
It's weird because I haven't been here since 2002, one of the first places I ever came when I was working for the BBC. Came to Bletchley. It was a really sad condition back then. And my dad and I came and we couldn't really understand why it wasn't more celebrated or clearly wasn't that well funded or even visited in big numbers. So coming back here now, it's like the place has been reborn. It's kids everywhere, busy, amazing facilities. And I just think one of the reasons could be because computers played less of a role in our lives. Even back in 2002, you know, they invented the internet and stuff. And we used it for research and emails back then. But now we are all walking around with supercomputers in our pocket the whole time. And I wonder whether society has finally given this place the respect that it does and the reverence it deserves. And as the computer revolution continues, this place is only going to get more and more important.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing that's probably happened in that period is people have started communicating in text rather than by voice. I mean, we all had mobile phones and we talked to each other. Now, for every phone call I make, I send 100 texts. And that takes you straight back to the Second World War and the, you know, Enigma operators sending short daily messages that everybody thought were inconsequential, but actually read in large numbers, told the Allies everything. Yeah. And that's the lesson that we try to give to, you know, school children nowadays, that it may seem dull to you, but the security threat is still there. This is still, you know, if people want to find out about you, it's surprisingly easy.
Well, the traffic analysis was born here, wasn't
it? Yeah.
And that's what's still used today.
I've always loved, from the day I got involved in television and way before, that's why I love visiting the places where history happened. It's the greatest privilege of my career and for all of us what we do. And so to be at, I went round there, was it Hut 6 where Lee?
Hut 3,
where messages about Alum Halfa, the, you know, famous battle, well, perhaps not famous enough battle at Montgomery for a defensive battle before the Battle of Alamein in late 1942, and managed to stop Rommel getting to the sewers, getting to the Suez Canal, basically, that would have passed through there. You know, and that is just so exciting to be in that space.
The Battles of El Alamein that you did with your dad.
First one.
First programme, wasn't it?
First programme, yeah.
And that's, I suppose, really one of the first major campaigns of World War II that Bletchley Park had played such a
they were really,
vital role.
The organisation really got up to speed by then, and they're able to provide significant amounts of intelligence to Montgomery. But also, the other thing that's getting up to speed by then is reading Italian messages so they can predict the supply convoys across the Mediterranean. And Rommel's operations are completely strangled by the fact that, you know, something like one in three ships, I think, are being sunk by the end, because they know when they're sailing and what's in them and where they're going. In addition to the places, I know something that you're heavily involved in and we do here is the people as well. I mean, one of the things I really enjoy here is we have a Veterans Day every September, but also throughout the year is meeting people who did this stuff. A lot of them are very elderly now, but the stories you get and the experience of meeting them is absolutely fantastic.
Well, yeah, I mean, I just think I've been talking about this for years. And the other day I talked to James Holland, the military historian, and we just thought we'd try and get something off the ground, the War Gen, just encouraging people to either upload material they've already got, like you guys, or interview their, well, it's probably their great-grandfathers now or their grandfathers. We've all got 4K HD phones in our pocket. I mean, get video them. Take their accounts down of these amazing battles before it's too late, because so many are gone now. I mean, I think about people that I've met. I've met Dan Busters, who have died. I've met Joe Eakins, who took out three Tigers with four rounds on Battle of Normandy. Jock Moffat, who dropped the torpedo at Bismarck in the Ruddy. You know, you just meet these guys. Eric Winkle Brown, Britain's greatest ever aviator. Met him a few times before he died last year. And you just think, we've got the technology now. We've got the technology to capture these voices, capture these images, and upload them. When I was in Germany, I met a lot of people that were interviewing all these World War II German Iron Cross winners. But this American woman was doing it, and it was all in her own personal archive. And I mean, if she goes under a bus, her kids might just chuck the thing out. I mean, so this is for everyone to upload, everyone to enjoy. And importantly, it's open source. So if people want to download it, make a radio play, make a podcast, make a TV documentary, they're more than welcome to do it. So we just think, at the time has come, let's make a big push and try and get that archive out there.
Because in America, Library of Congress have been interviewing veterans for decades now, haven't they? World War II veterans. And we just haven't done it, have we? And like you say, getting to meet these people, it's not just what we learn from them, it's what we can give back to them, isn't it? Because we allow them to tell their stories.
You know, that is a really good point. And we were talking about this earlier, which is, actually, that if it's in a, you know, their chance to actually talk about it and share their experiences can really enliven some of these veterans, and they deserve to have their stories told. And also, they think it's not important, but once you start talking, as you and I have said, it will just come out of them in a flood, and they love talking about it. And it's very special. If I had a pound for every friend of mine who's come up to me, sort of almost tearful, said, "Can't believe my granddad died, my grandma, she was a Wren, he was an X, Y, and Z." And I never really asked them what they did before they died, and that's tragic.
I mean, I had the same with my stepdad. He didn't want to talk about his war experience. He was a fleet air arm, and he did a lot of convoys. He'd talk about the jazz band he was in, but interviewing people in different ways and just gently asking them questions, you get different things out of them, and you will get valuable history, whether it's personal history or military history or war history.
Well, that's the main thing. It's all the stories of one. My granddad's stories were all about, he did the convoys, Battle of the Atlantic, and they're all about the silly stuff and the fun stuff. But I mean, they're great stories, worth saving, and very funny. And an antidote to the idea that it was all very stiff upper lip and Noel Coward. You know, they were, my grandpa on this Canadian ship, he was on the Royal Canadian HMCS Prince Robert. It was very casual, it was very civilian, you know, they were quite naughty. Some officers, like pre-war regulars, would come on board and they'd quite quickly make sure they were tossed overboard or had a load of paint poured on top of their heads and stuff. You know, you get a lot from those funnier stories, and you can tell a lot about the sort of culture at the time, and they challenge the myths.
I also think that it's terribly easy to think of these people, our veterans here are now in their 90s, and you go, that's a little old lady, but they're talking about when they were 19. And I've had veterans talk to me about the fact that they come off an 8-hour shift on the bomb machines and then they climb out the window and go up to London, go clubbing, and come back at sort of 6 o'clock in the morning to go back to work.
Oh.
And, you know, when I was 19, I might have been able to do that. If I tried it now, it'd kill me.
Well, it's only six years ago, buddy. Don't do it.
But it's that spirit and that youth that, you know, you tend to forget if you don't sort of get into them. And those stories really emphasise that aspect of it. It was a young person's war in that way.
Yeah. And my advice would be, if people do want to get involved into it, I mean, I think really ask those naughty questions. I mean, I think military historians are obsessed by units and where they were at different times and different training and equipment. I mean, if you feel comfortable, ask them about women and men and drinking and, you know, breaking the rules and stuff, because that's the really great, that's the great stuff. And a lot of it went on. I met a woman in Westminster Abbey for the, would it be Battle of Britain 75 maybe in Westminster Abbey? And she was a fire watcher in Westminster Abbey. She was 18 years old, and her job was to stay up all night with a load of other 18-year-olds in Westminster Abbey to check incendiary devices and start fires. And she just looks at me and she, you know, the stuff we got up to. I mean, the mind boggles. Can you imagine how fun that would have been? Loads of men and women all chucked in Westminster Abbey for the night, doors locked and no questions
asked. And they were living for the day, weren't they?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was that was the time. That was what was happening.
Yeah.
You've said you came here in 2002 and another 14 years later, it's changed so much. For you, what does Bletchley Park mean to you just as a place and what its importance in history is?
Well, it's hard to overstate its importance, isn't it? I mean, it is responsible for the greatest gathering and processing of military intelligence in the history of warfare. As if that wasn't enough, it also was a crucible in which the modern information, data-led world was forged. The people that left here had the expertise and the knowledge and the inspiration to go on and start the computer revolution, literally individuals going off and doing that. And therefore, it's really hard to overstate its contribution to the world. You look back at hindsight and say, well, the intelligence, basically what defeats the enemy is aircraft carriers and infantry divisions and enough shells and aircraft and bombs. The Allies probably would have still won the war anyway. And of course, that's possibly true, but we don't know that. And what we do know is that maybe it was coincidental, maybe it wasn't, but the side that established complete information dominance went on to win the war.
Yeah.
And actually, the Battle of the Atlantic was quite finely poised. At times, arguably, the Battle of Normandy was quite funny points. And if it hadn't been for that information dominance, it's hard to say what might have happened. And there are a whole bunch of different outcomes of World War II that look a lot less attractive than the one that actually we got. So I think it's impossible sometimes to really understand what they achieved here. But all you can say is that their achievements absolutely ensured that the liberal Western democracies won the war in Western Europe and the Pacific and helped bring about the defeat of the Third Reich.
Let's look back 100 years to World War I, when there was more than one intelligence organisation hard at work deciphering codes and helping to build a picture, not only of what the enemy was doing, but what they were thinking about doing next as well. This month's It Happened Here story is about how the US became embroiled in World War I. The threat from Germany came home to the United States thanks to an intercepted telegram sent by the German Foreign Secretary Arthur Zimmermann. The tricky thing was, British intelligence didn't want the States finding out that they were reading what was coming over those cables. That made it rather difficult to warn the US without giving the game away and thereby doing enormous diplomatic damage. Coming up, we'll hear from the grandsons of two key figures in this story. One played his part in decrypting this all-important message in Room 40 and went on to be crucial to code-breaking during World War II as well. The other was our man in Mexico at the time. Back in the summer, their grandsons met up at Bletchley Park and reflected on the significance of the telegram and their ancestors' involvement in bringing it to light. First, let's take up the story with Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
David, we're rewinding a whole 100 years, which is a good 25 years further than we usually do to look at World War II. I think people, even with a working knowledge of World War II, might, if anything like me, find World War I a bit of a mystery. Now, this is your area of expertise. You were a World War I historian before you came to Bletchley Park. So I'm going to put myself completely in your hands and ask you to tell me, firstly, we were 3 years into the war by this time. Why weren't America already involved?
The Americans weren't in the war until quite late on because they had adopted a very isolationist foreign policy. Their view was that they could stay in sort of continental America and that events in Europe wouldn't really affect them. And in particular, they could continue to trade with not only the UK, but other powers. And really, as far as possible, they could stay out of the war.
Well, it's a faraway place, Europe, from America. I can understand that point of view.
It was, but it's close to home for some people because the great wave of immigration into the United States at the end of the 19th and the early beginning of the 20th century, you've got a lot of first-generation people from Europe who are living there. But that really divides opinion because you have a big German community who are siding with the Germans. You have British and Irish people who, some of the Irish had taken one side or the other. The British obviously supporting the Allied cause. So public opinion is quite divided. There's no great swell of opinion that they should get involved in the war.
Probably then more than now, that 100 years probably makes quite a difference in how much Americans generally felt connected to their European or wherever they'd migrated to America from roots. You know, if they're only first or second generation, that link's going to feel much stronger, isn't it?
Oh, yes. I mean, the communities are still speaking the languages they spoke back in Europe and living the same sort of lives.
So everyone will have felt quite strongly.
People will have felt quite strongly, but not everyone is feeling the same thing. So when national opinions really divided like that, the government wasn't under particular pressure in one direction or another. Wilson, you get the sense that he was instinctively pro the Allies.
So but he's president at the
time. He's president at the time. But he was also aware that the war, viewed from an outsider, was an unpleasant and expensive business that wasn't really going anywhere, particularly by 1917. So he didn't want to get into a big commitment. The US is already quite committed commercially because their companies are supplying both the British and French armies with huge amounts of stuff. The British are buying huge quantities of ammunition from America, for example. So they're already doing quite well out of the war without being in it. Probably the closest they'd come to getting involved was in 1915 with the sinking of the Lusitania, which was a civilian ocean liner that was sunk by a U-boat just off the coast of Ireland. And at that point, because a number of Americans were on board, there was a brief kind of something must be done outrage.
Was that crossing of a line into killing civilians then?
There's a whole legal sort of quagmire, really, because the way the laws of the sea applied at that period, and indeed apply to this day, it's quite complicated that fleets are allowed to intercept merchant ships that are supplying their enemy, but neutral vessels aren't supposed to be attacked. And Britain claimed the right to search any ship that was coming sort of towards Europe, and the British Navy would quite frequently confiscate ships that they thought were supplying the Germans. The Germans have a more aggressive policy. They're using U-boat submarines to actually sink ships. The procedure was supposed to be that you would surface alongside the ship, give the crew a chance to get off into their lifeboats or whatever, search the ship, and then torpedo it afterwards.
Yeah.
And then you were legally somehow responsible for the crew. Mm. In the olden days, before submarines, you would have taken the crew onto your own ship and then dropped them off at a neutral port or something like that. But with submarines, you can't take very many people on board other than the people who are on there already. So the Germans were already on kind of sticky legal ground, sinking ships without warning. Their argument was that the British had started putting guns on some of their merchant ships, which makes them warships in a way. Mm. And they would say, well, we're only putting guns on them because you're torpedoing us without warning. And it, you know, the legal argument about whether it was a war crime continues to this day, really. But the Americans are increasingly getting entangled in that because they're supplying a lot of war material to Britain and France. And the Germans obviously want to prevent that. And the background to the Zimmermann story in particular was that the Germans had decided that because the war wasn't getting anywhere on land on the Western Front in Europe, that if they launched what's called unrestricted U-boat warfare in the Atlantic, they might be able to strangle Britain of resources and force them out of the war economically, essentially. The unrestricted part means that they basically sink any ship, regardless of the flag it's showing, if it's heading towards Britain and France. And it's quite a radical step because you risk antagonising all sorts of neutral countries whose ships are sailing around ostensibly freely in the Atlantic. So they decided in the beginning of January that would be their policy beginning at the start of February.
And so who knew about that?
The decision was taken at the highest level. It was the Kaiser and his cabinet who took the decision with advice from their generals and admirals that unrestricted U-boat warfare would be the way to go. And they hoped that that would allow them to economically strangle Britain fairly quickly. They were more confident than they should have been in the effectiveness of their submarines.
So then enter Arthur Zimmermann. Who is Arthur Zimmermann?
Arthur Zimmermann is the foreign minister in the German government at the time. And the problem they have is if they start sinking lots of merchant ships, disregarding where they come from, they're going to antagonise the Americans because a lot of those ships will be American. And the danger is that this will tip the balance in favour of America joining the war. So what they have to do is come up with a plan that will undermine the American effort against Germany. And the solution they come up with is if they can drag Mexico into the war, because there's a history of antagonism between Mexico and the United States during the previous few years. If they can drag Mexico into the war, make them attack America, that will distract the Americans from getting involved in Europe. And it's relevant because the Mexican Revolution has been staggering on for a number of years at that point, and Mexican governments have changed, and there's a civil war essentially taking place in Mexico. You'll have heard of Zapata, and there's a lot of old Sergio Leone movies sort of set in the Mexican Revolution. And the US Army had actually intervened in Mexico on a couple of occasions on a small scale. So it wasn't a ludicrous idea that war would happen between Mexico and America. There was enough border tension and stuff going on that it was a feasible idea. Their plan was they were going to brief the Mexicans to say, if America comes in the war, please come in on our side. That was the plan. And so they had to communicate that information to the Mexicans before the U-boat warfare started. So they've got a sort of 3 or 4 week window to get all their diplomatic chess pieces in place before the ships start sinking.
Against that background then, what was specifically put to Mexico in this telegram?
Well, they were offered financial and military support to attack the US. And historically, a big part of the southern United States used to be Mexico. Texas, parts of Arizona, parts of California were all Mexico until the 1840s. And so Germany basically said, you can have the bits of the US that were historically Mexican. We will support, when the peace treaty comes around and America and Britain have been defeated, when we sit at that peace conference, we will basically make sure that Mexico gets that big chunk of America.
Reclaim what it lost.
And the other thing that people forget is that the United States, in its modern form, is still evolving at that point. There's a number of territories, as they're called, particularly in the West, that aren't formally states yet. The country hasn't become as cohesive as it is nowadays in terms of all the states having similar representation and everything else.
So military and financial help to reclaim some of its lost territory, that must have been quite an appealing notion.
Well, it was and it wasn't. I mean, the Mexican government response was that this was a pretty crazy idea. I mean, they'd been fighting amongst themselves. The Mexican Revolution had been going on for some time. And so they didn't really have the military resources to attack the US in any meaningful way. The man who's president in Mexico at the time has not been long in the job. And, well, there's three things. They're suspicious of the Germans. They think that this might be, you know, hot air from the Germans. They're not particularly militarily and economically equipped to do it. And their third point, kind of remember the Alamo, the idea that they could take over Texas and that the Texans would just settle down with being Mexican again, it's just not going to happen. Yeah. So the Mexican government basically think the whole thing's a bit of a waste of time. But that's not really the point. The point is that the Germans have made the offer.
How damaging was that offer from a US point of view? I mean, they're obviously already supplying the Allies with arms, and Germany will have been well aware of that. That tacitly takes sides anyway, doesn't it, without getting out and out involved. But if you're looking at that as an American government official, how many alarm bells would that set off? Or would it just seem like, oh, this is pie in the sky?
Whether it's pie in the sky or not, the American policy at the time is isolationist in the sense that they're not bothered about what happens outside continental America. But they are very twitchy about foreign powers getting involved within continental America. You know, the idea that a European power might stir up Mexico really touches a sore spot with the Americans, because they consider continental America to be their territory, even though, you know, there are other countries there that aren't the US. They still consider it completely their sphere of influence, and that's their bit, and they're quite happy to be hands-off in Europe so long as we leave the Americas alone. And so the idea that a major European power would get involved on continental America, they find, well, almost insulting in a way. It really touches a sore spot with them. And the British know this. They know that this is hot stuff, this message. So that the real trick is, how do you communicate the information to the Americans and do it in a timely way? Because once the message had been understood by the British, they wanted to kind of hang on to it and go, well, we may not need this particular time bomb. If the Americans calm down once the U-boat warfare has started and they don't declare war, then it doesn't really matter. But if they look like they're going to, then that's when we need to drop it into the mix. It wasn't as simple as, oh, we found this information, we'll share it with them. the way intelligence works. The moment you know something that your enemies or even your friends don't know, that gives you the high ground, and you don't want to part with that necessarily unless you know you're really going to get payback for it. So there's a lot of careful consideration of how to deal with it. And the other problem is, of course, how we acquired it.
One of Britain's first actions of the war was a master stroke of communication sabotage. On the night of the 4th of August 1914, five of Germany's six cables in the English Channel were cut. The sixth cable was redirected to be used by the British to intercept German communications. Britain had already recognised the importance of cable. It encircled the world with lines and ran them only across its own red territories and under the ocean. The all-red line was considered complete by 1911. Not only were UK cables protected from interference, many foreign powers were forced to use Britain's extensive network for their own messaging. Britain was in the ideal position to intercept friends and foes alike.
The problem for British intelligence in this situation is that in 1914, both the British and the Germans hooked up each other's undersea cables, telegraph cables, and cut them to prevent the other powers communicating. And so the Germans have had their transatlantic cables cut, so they find it very difficult to communicate with their embassies abroad and sort of run their affairs. So they have a slightly strange arrangement that the US have agreed to send German telegraph traffic, government telegraph traffic for them. And what's happened is once the telegram has been prepared, Zimmermann's message, it's actually taken to the US embassy in Berlin, and the US government send it via Copenhagen. Then there's a cable from Copenhagen to the United States, and it travels along that. The point why this story came about is that cable passes through Porthcurno in Cornwall, and the British have an opportunity to intercept everything that's on that cable, which of course they've been doing. But it's an American neutral cable. We didn't ought to be reading their mail, but we are. So if the British reveal that they've got the information, the Americans are obviously going to be extremely annoyed that we're listening to their cable traffic. The other problem the Germans have is once it's got to Washington, it then needs to be forwarded to Mexico. And again, that connection is made over just the normal commercial telegraph routes with Western Union. Obviously, it's encrypted at the various stages. They think they're sending it privately. The message has arrived, has been tapped off the cable by the British, and they translate enough of it very, very quickly in room 40 in the Admiralty to see that it's hot stuff. And then over the next few days, they manage to break the rest of it and get the complete picture. But they're then presented with a conundrum. Well, several conundrums. The first is, how do you tell the Americans without revealing that we're listening to their messages? And secondly, how do you convince the Americans we haven't just made it up to try and persuade them? The authenticity of the message is also absolutely crucial. Because if we just handed it over and said, we've got this, but we can't tell you where we got it from, people are very sceptical about it. So there has to be sort of independent evidence that it is genuinely a German message. And this is where the sort of the clever bit comes in, because the Admiralty realised that the message had gone to Washington and had then been sent by commercial cable to Mexico. And the German ambassador in Mexico, Eckhart, had got it, and he could then go and talk to the Mexican government and everything else. The British embassy in Mexico City managed to bribe somebody at the commercial telegraph office in Mexico to give them all the messages that had come in between the German embassy in Washington and the German embassy in Mexico. And they got a number of messages. And what they could then say is to the Americans, we haven't bugged your cable, we've simply bought the messages in Mexico. And that's what they did.
Dodgy officials.
Yeah, we managed to, you know, bribe somebody down here
grease
and get
the
message.
Wheels, yeah.
What they also said to the Americans was, if you don't believe us, go to Western Union in Washington and look through their records, and they'll have a copy of the message at that end as well, which of course is what the Americans did, and they got a copy of it. The additional problem is that the Americans weren't at that point in a position where they could decrypt it, because they didn't understand the codes as well as the British did. This causes another problem, because you don't necessarily want to share your code-breaking knowledge as well. And just to complicate matters, it's written in two different codes. The one that goes to Washington is in a different code from the one that goes from Washington to Mexico. So the British had broken both, but they only admitted to breaking one, which was the one connecting to Mexico.
What a tangled web.
It's an incredibly tangled web. And then the buck passes to Washington, because then Wilson, the president, and his government have the next problem, which is, what do we do with it? You know, do we release it to the press what's going to happen, because obviously there's going to be a big public reaction to it. He's then at the point where going, do I want to whip up enthusiasm for war with Germany or not? So he's got his own dilemma.
Hello. The room is not very big and there are still two or three more to fit in. Where were you before being recruited to this department?
I was up at Cambridge doing European languages, enjoying rowing, rugby, beer and playing mahjong.
Here. Let's hope you enjoy deciphering intercepted German messages just as much. But first things first, we must get you a cup of tea.
It took a complicated path around the world then. It wasn't just sent from A to B, it was sent from B to F and F over to W. And when it landed on the desks in room 40, how did they tackle it?
Well, at that point, it was enciphered in a German code that was partially understood by the guys in room 40. It's a book code which relies on groups of numbers, between three and five numbers, for each code group. And those groups, in some cases, refer to whole words or phrases, in other cases, refer to, you can spell out letters, letter by letter. And there's a process called book building, which is where, once you've figured out how the code works, you create a blank book with all the numbers in it. And as you work out what words are, you kind of pencil them in. And ultimately, you hope to recreate the whole code book, because if you find one word, you can infer what the next word in the message might be, that then you can add another word to your dictionary, if you like. And the book for the particular code the message was sent in was not by any means complete at that time, so they were having to do a certain amount of guesswork. And the early drafts they got, there were some sentences they're like, well, it's something to do with Mexico, but with, you know, but not exactly sure how it fits together. The fortunate part is that when the message was retransmitted from Washington to Mexico, it was sent in a different German code, which actually the Admiralty understood a lot better. So having been kind of tipped off of its importance from a draft that was incomplete, once they knew what they were looking for and they were able to get the other version of it, the other version was much easier to decode. And that's the version that they were then able to pass on to the Americans. But of course, the work that had been done in the first code, which was the one that they'd actually taken off the American cable, they never said anything about that bit, part of it, to the Americans. So that code was never shared. It was only the second encryption that was shared. The whole purpose is to keep back as much as is humanly possible. It's instinctive for these kind of people not to tell anything that you don't have to tell. But the problem was the American understanding of the second code, the Washington to Mexico code, was much worse than the British. So we had to give them a little bit of help with the decryption, share a little bit of the code with them so they could break it themselves and believe that it was genuine. Because, of course, if we just told them what the decryption was without sharing how we'd done it, that would have been less believable.
Some of those key figures that we've heard about having gone on to Bletchley Park, Dilly Knox, you mentioned, there was also Nigel de Grey. Now, didn't he annotate the decryption of the telegram? And isn't that how his grandsons got on to the fact that he'd been involved?
Yes, there are now files that have been released that have the original partial decrypts and the intercept documents with both Knox and de Grey's handwriting on them, making little annotations of what they think the word, because you've got the number groups and then there's words written in longhand over the top of what they think those words are, and then gaps with the numbers they don't know. And so you can see the actual physical code-breaking process going on there. In the midst of all this, of course, on 1st of February, unrestricted submarine warfare starts and American ships start getting sunk. And so the public starts to turn against the Germans and the Americans are sort of creeping towards war. But they start off by simply arming merchant vessels and doing sort of
soft
halfway
measures.
House soft yeah. measures. They break off diplomatic relations with the Germans on the 3rd of February. And at that point, they've still got the telegram, but they're, you know, what do we do?
It wasn't like flicking a switch. It was more of a big step in the build-up to America entering the war.
Yes. Once the Americans have got the telegram, they also do their own investigation, see if they can find a copy of it at their end and everything else. And they become convinced that he's firstly genuine and secondly very important. And at the end of February, on the 28th, Wilson, the president, decides that it should be released to the press. And it causes headlines all over the world. It becomes a huge story. Various versions of it are produced. A supposedly verbatim text of the message appears in the newspapers. But there's a whole story behind that, because that version is slightly different to the various versions of the message. Because it's not really one message. It's been sent several times by different people. So getting to the exact wording is quite difficult, but the wording that most people are familiar with is the wording that appears in the papers on 28th of February. Diplomatic relations have been broken off, ships are getting sunk, the slippery slope to America being in the war is fairly steep at that point. And indeed, the Americans do come into the war on April the 6th, which is sort of 5-6 weeks later. During that period, of course, the Germans actually admitted that they'd sent it, which might sound a bit weird. You'd think they'd be denying it, going, oh, this is all a fabrication by the press. But actually, Zimmermann decided that it would be better to own up to it. But his argument was this was a condition on if America entered the war, we'd then pay the Mexicans. But if America didn't enter the war, we wouldn't do anything. He was trying to make it appear conditional and say, if you stay out of the war, we're not going to do anything to you. We're not going to pay the Mexicans to do anything. It's only if you come into the war that you'll get in trouble from the Mexicans. He saw it as a kind of a threat to say to America, you need to stay out, because if you come in, this is what's going to happen. You know, you're going to have a war on two fronts, et cetera, et cetera. But that just annoyed everyone more, I think. And, you know, the rest is history. The Americans come into the war in April. Their first troops don't fight in France for a long time into 1918. But, you know, looking at German strategy after the middle of 1917, while it'll take the Americans a little while to get in, once they're in, that's it for the Germans. Whereas previously the Germans have been able to say, we can just stay put on the Western Front or wherever else in Russia or whatever and let the Allies exhaust themselves. It now becomes apparent that the tide is against them, and once the Americans come in with all their resources and manpower and everything else, they will ultimately be defeated. So they have to start thinking about a way to win the war rather than just survive it. So they have to alter their strategy at that point. And 18 months later, they've lost.
So we have an unusual gathering here today. Could you introduce yourselves, please?
Yes, I'll start as I'm the oldest here. My name is Michael de Grey, and my grandfather was called Nigel de Grey.
And I'm Anthony de Grey, and I am Michael's brother, therefore the same rules apply.
And I'm Edward Hewler, quite clearly the youngest here by miles. My grandfather was Tom Hewler, Thomas Hewler.
The Zimmermann telegram is what brings you together today.
Yes. It does.
100 years ago, this was an incredible story. Could somebody summarise it for me?
The Zimmermann telegram was sent from Germany by Zimmermann to Mexico, proposing to Mexico that they should join together, attack the United States, and that as a reward they would get back the three states that surround Mexico that had been taken away from them. However, in this country we were, possibly not totally legally, listening in to the wires that went through this country that picked up Germany and Sweden and indeed the Americans. And room 40, which is where people were trying to decode these messages, picked up this message. And the message was decoded by my grandfather Nigel, assisted by Dilly Knox and Montgomery, who were language specialists particularly, because, of course, the actual telegram were numbers, so it had to be got into German before it could be got into English. It was decided in this country that we would not say that we had decoded this message because we didn't want the Germans to know that we'd broken the code. So a way was found of getting the telegram from Mexico to the Americans, so that they didn't realise that it had come, actually was coming at our behest, but was coming from Mexico.
And Edward, I gather this is where your grandfather comes into the story.
He was in Mexico at the time as the representative of His Britannic Majesty during a large part of what was a revolution that I think ran from 1911 till 1916 in Mexico.
But I think it would have been a very lively time to be there. Interesting times, as they say.
I think indeed it was. Certainly in some of the manuscripts he produced at the time, part of his duties were getting trainloads of Americans back safely over the border. And I gather every other trainload was blown up by Mexican bandits or various different factions of Mexican society at that time. I think it's worth saying, if I can add to Michael's point made earlier, that I think I'm right in saying the Zimmerman telegram didn't only encourage the Mexicans to come into the war on the side of Germany in order to recover Arizona, Texas, New Mexico.
I think that's right.
There was also, towards the end of the telegram, I think a suggestion that the Japanese might also enter on the side of the Germans and the Mexicans with a view to obtaining a seaboard on the western coast of North America.
And then perhaps I could just also add, the other crucial part of the telegram was that the Germans were to start unrestricted submarine warfare, which meant that they were going to sink neutral shipping, which of course therefore included American shipping. And they were hoping that with these distractions, the Americans wouldn't be able to fight the war in Europe on the Allies' side, because these shenanigans that they were trying to put in place would keep them too busy in America.
So all in all, this one short telegram was pretty hot stuff, wasn't it?
Possibly the single most important piece of decoding ever. Obviously, Enigma in general was much more important, but for a single piece of decoding, perhaps the most important piece ever in the consequences.
David Kahn, the first person to write about this, called it the single most important piece of decoding ever.
So how did this come across his desk?
Some of the details, I suspect, were sketchy, even as they were reported in his book, The Stormy Petrel. That was his nickname in the Foreign Office, because every country he went to promptly dissolved into civil war, commotion, strife, and any other disaster imaginable. Don't quite know why he attracted such interest, but clearly there was divine intervention there, yes. But as far as, if I come back to the Zimmerman telegram, as I understand it, he was having his hair cut downtown Mexico City, where he overheard a publisher speaking who had discovered something in his printing press left there by one of his workers, which, had it been discovered by anyone outside of the publishing house, would have had him immediately executed. The publisher had, I think, removed the offending article, not knowing it had been left there by his employee. The employee came back and found that the papers that he had left in the office were no longer there. So I think by this stage, both of these individuals were in a heightened state of anxiety, not knowing who had the evidence. And my grandfather, having overheard this, I think knew the publisher, and I believe over a drink, which some people have described as bribery, I think that's taking it a little bit too far in defense of my grandfather's reputation, managed to secure the telegram through the publisher, for it was through his printing press that I think the wires were traveling.
Bribery or no bribery, it got the job done, didn't it? If there are ways
of achieving. Do you think he might have had any clue that was what what the British were wanting to do? And maybe that he knew that was the place to go?
That I don't know.
I'm only sort of speculating.
He was certainly fully aware of the import of what he was doing.
Yeah.
And subsequently, he had wrote what I can only describe as a rather pathetic letter that I have seen, but not for many years now, to, I think, some distant relative of yours who might have been Sir Edward Grey, who was heading up the Foreign Office at that stage. And he felt that for the services he'd done for king and country, that he deserved a little bit more of a reward than what he ultimately received.
The belief that we've all read or heard or we've talked about here, I think, is that he might have been asked to do something. But until you read your book again and see it again, we shan't know for certain. But he did it. The interesting thing is that having got this telegram to the Americans, of course, couldn't decode it. They sent the telegram back to London, where Nigel de Grey was asked to go and help them decode it. So he had to pretend he didn't know what it said. And that's how the Americans finally got the version they could understand, and that they realised the import of it. And the fact is that it was so important that it added to the other things that had happened, made them, I think, finally decide to join the war.
Yeah. You can imagine they must have got the impression of your grandfather an absolute genius, and probably asking for him to come back in and decode other messages.
I couldn't possibly comment. I don't. But it is a very surreal situation.
Deception, isn't it? Absolutely.
But going back to your point about reward being rewarded, I think it's fair to say that none of the people who were seminal to this story were rewarded properly on grounds of secrecy, because you couldn't really put their heads up above the parapet. And I think it's probably even more true in the Second World War that people got no recognition at all, because at least the Room 40 story did come out relatively soon after the First World War. But it wasn't until, what, the late 70s, really, that anything came out about Bletchley Park. We knew nothing about what Nigel had done at all. And he died when I was 8 and a half. Well, I remember him well, and I know the sort of person he's why I've got letters from him, all sorts of things. He came here to Bletchley Park in the Second World War, as did my father in the latter half of the war. And my father did not tell us anything. I believe that after the First World War, they did put some sort of secrecy on the people who'd done decoding. But in the Second World War, they had everybody had signed the Official Secrets Act. And that meant that we learnt nothing from my father about what he did. And did he know anything about what his father did? We don't know. My father died about 2 years before Kahn's book came out. So although one's been able to research it, and Anthony certainly has done some research, and we've learnt more by coming here, and my mother, who lived until 1999, clearly knew absolutely nothing about it at all. Nothing at all.
No.
I once found a Russian primer or translation book, and it was clearly connected to something my father had done at some point. It may have been just after the war, because he did stay in the service for a while after the war. And he said, well, of course we spied on the Russians to know the movements of their trains, because that told us where they were moving troops and so on. But that was because I found something that he inadvertently hadn't put away, I suppose.
I would imagine. Yeah. I had an experience too when I was working for the sadly lost Courage's Brewery at the time, and I went into one of our pubs, and I went in and I introduced myself to the landlord, and he said, oh, De Grey, I think I must have worked with your father during the war. So I said, oh, really? And I didn't sort of think anything. I can remember the chap's name, I shan't tell you, but I told my father this, and knowing the sort of person my father was, I'll bet you he rang somebody up, because they were still subject to the Official Secrets Act at that time. And I bet they were all if that sort of thing happened, they were instructed to say so. Yeah. And I would, knowing him, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah,
I think he would have rung up the Home Office, or whoever he had to ring up, he would have had a phone number. I have no doubt about it.
I was a landscape gardener in my early life, well, most of my life, actually, and I had a stand at Hampton Court. And somebody came up, the lady came up to me and pressed me firmly by the hand. Oh, I worked with your father in the war, but I never got any more out of her.
No.
And never heard from her again. She said she was going to get in touch with me, so I stupidly didn't take any details. Tantalising.
And you trusted her to
Yes, but this is all part of the lost story, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
But well, I just think it's wonderful that we can get grandchildren of such an important event. And we've had, of course, Dilly Knox's grandson here as well.
Yes.
So perhaps we ought to try and get all of the participants together.
I don't think we'll find much to do with Montgomery, because he was a priest, wasn't he?
Yeah, this is interesting. I mean, Montgomery has disappeared. William Montgomery has disappeared completely, other than as a name, and that we know that he was a priest. I've tried Googling him and found nothing about him, and I can only assume that he had no siblings, because nobody's come forward. But it would be marvellous if somebody listens to the podcast and has some connection with him, because it's actually a missing piece of the jigsaw.
Yes.
Oh, yes, if you do, get in touch.
Yes.
I've grown up with red leather-bound volumes in the library at home, where he filed away meticulously all his diplomatic papers. I'm quite sure that was considered standard practice at the time. But they're there, the letters went out and those came in. And he was, I would think, for his era, unusual in his use of the camera. So there's quite a lot of photographs of his travels around the world. And the papers are beautifully stamped up in gold, so I can very quickly identify 1911 to 1916. And both sides of those particular dates, mapping his career from the beginning right through to the end.
How does it feel to be here today then, together?
I think it's just a really nice occasion to link up in the way we have.
And an important one as well, I think, don't you? Because the whole story is so important, and I know we weren't participants in it, but we feel part of the story.
Well, having heard so much about Bletchley Park, it's very, very kind of you to have us, and it's wonderful to meet the great family. Mm. A joy to be here today.
Our grandparents never met, so for us to meet two generations later, I think it's great.
So yes. It's never too late.
Never too late.
No, to tell the story and to find more bits and put more bits of it together.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that more bits will come out. One just hopes that people don't throw old records away thinking they're not of interest. They are.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your day here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Very good.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and Catherine White and supported by Audio Boom. If you like this podcast, don't be shy, write us a ripping review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.